Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, and this week in Reykjavik, it's been a quiet week for me. The nights are setting in. I'm recording this at 5:30 on an evening, and it's already dark. I've already got my curtains drawn, so it's really, really getting dark here right now. I always think of Iceland as being one of the darkest, coldest places. But from seeing Twitter this week, there's a lot of people out in different parts of the states that have already got snow. And I forget that, like, some places in Canada and the north of the United States maybe have it colder than we do here in Iceland, actually. So even if we're not the coldest place and we don't have snow already, we are definitely one of the darkest. And this time of year is a good time to be a gamer. The nights set in early. When it's horrible outside, there's less going on. There's less to worry about missing. And so it's the perfect time to dig into a bunch of games. And that's what I've been doing. So I have a few good games to talk about this week. A couple of not so good games as well. It's been a mixed week in terms of me actually enjoying what I've been playing. But I have a few games to talk about. At the start of the show, I'm going to give some initial impressions of The Entropy Center, really fun Portal-like game with a time gun. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about God of War Ragnarok. I did review the 2018 game last week, and I have started that sequel. And for the reviews of the show, there's going to be two this week. There's one game that I was looking forward to for quite a while. I've featured it in previews and so forth. That is Somerville by Jumpship, which came out on Game Pass this week. And I'm also going to talk about a game that I've been playing for quite a while and have done a second run on because I got terribly stuck halfway through it. So I did a second run on this game just to see if I could do better. So there's been a month between my two playthroughs, and I arrived at a somewhat similar conclusion the second time around. And that game is Four Tales, an interesting narrative forward card game where you use cards in unusual ways, as well as in the traditional card battling way. But there was actually some news this week that I thought it might be interesting to touch on at the start of the show. If you're a member of the show's Discord, then you will know that I am someone that likes list making, that likes rating things, and that likes Game of the Year season. I love to rate things against each other. I don't know why exactly. I've always enjoyed doing this. I think I remember making lists of my top five favorite things, even as a kid. And on the show's Discord server, we have a top fives channel where we talk about our top five whatever. We talk about our top five pixel art games. We talk about our top five melee combat games, our top five Nintendo games of all time. And there's always something new, and it's just fun thinking through it, just leafing through all of your favorite things and pulling it into some kind of order. So I really like awards season as well. Even if a lot of times my favourite games aren't represented fully there. But the big one is the Game Awards, the annual show that happens at the end of the year. Awards nominations close pretty early for this game, so some games that come out in like November and December are a little bit too late for the Game Awards, but it is the first awards show of each year, and that's because it happens so soon. And I do think that that's smart because it gets to lead the conversation about what the games of the year are, and it is doing that right now. The nominations are voted on by a whole bunch of media sources. I'm just browsing now who the jury consists of, and there are 20 or so from the US, including things like What's Good Games, Vice.com, Polygon, Kinda Funny, IGN, all of that kind of stuff, Games Radar, etc. Easy Allies is in there, which is nice to see. In the UK, there are a handful, such as The Guardian, Edge, Eurogamer, NME. And then globally, there tend to be like 1 to 3 in lots of different countries. Like there's one in, like I'm just leafing through now, 1 in Croatia, 4 in Germany, etc. So it has like over 100 different people voting for it. So I can see why it's a big calendar event for gaming, and I can see why it kicks off the awards season. And it's always interesting to see what they come up with. I tend to find that there is like a hegemony in the voting where everyone gravitates to just a couple of games and it's all quite predictable. But there is also usually a couple of curveballs and usually a couple of my favorite indie titles make it into them in some way, shape or form. And that has happened again. So best game of the year, the game of the year category is, it has A Plague Tale Requiem, which is very, very present in this year's Game Awards. I've only played an hour of that one or so, and I wasn't that into it, so I kind of skipped it and bounced on it. But Elden Ring and God of War Ragnarok are there as well. Horizon Forbidden West, I'm really happy to see, of course. Stray made an appearance, which I'm really happy about. It's lovely to see an indie game punch through into Game of the Year. And then Xenoblade Chronicles 3, which I haven't played. But there has been a little bit of pushback about Stray. I've seen a lot of people on Twitter saying that they were surprised to see it there. And I can get that, but it is, I mean, of this list, only Horizon and Stray are in my kind of working top 10 for the year. So I'm really happy to see Stray there, actually. It's nice to see an indie game punch through and do well and to get into the Game of the Year awards. I was very surprised to not see Immortality there. After all the 10 out of 10s that it got, and having played it myself, it's really a game changer and should be in the Game of the Year conversation. But that's the thing with these votes, right? If there are 100 different institutions, media sources, influencers, etc., voting on this, then maybe it comes down to, in a way, like what they chose to play. And I think that Immortality, for all of its brilliance, a lot of people bounced on it. Like, I've talked to people and recommended it to a lot of people, and they have said, like, I'm put off by the video thing. I don't want to sit and watch video when I'm playing a game. I want to control, you know, I want to control Aloy, or I want to be killing things in Elden Ring. And so just the format of Immortality is perhaps a handicap that has stopped it from being literally played by enough journalists to be voted into the Game of the Year category here. It does seem like a bit of an oversight. And I do wonder about the editorial control that Jeff Keighley takes over these categories. Like, we are told that there are 100 sources voting on them, but we are not told if it is like pure democracy, if you know what I mean, if the votes are counted and that's what happens. I would predict that he probably uses these votes as a guide to popularity and does exercise some editorial control over the categories as a business, and the Game Awards is a business for sure. It's not just like a humanitarian event or a cultural event. They sell a huge amount of ads and so forth. And so having Nintendo in the Game of the Year category, for example, is something that seems to make business sense. And people that have played Xenoblade Chronicles 3 love it, but I was surprised to see it there. Like, if you think about the games that people really played this year, have the majority of critics played Xenoblade Chronicles? I'm not sure. But there it is. So I have some thoughts about how these categories are chosen, and I would love to know more about it. I would love to know if it is purely democratic in the way that it seems to suggest that it is. But that's not the only category that's interesting. Best Game Direction, Immortality does get a nomination there. So does Stray. And then the big three, which I guess is Elden Ring, Ragnarok, and Horizon. Immortality also gets a nod in Best Narrative. Elden Ring there too, which is a bit of a surprise to me, seeing as the story barely exists in that game and is pretty questionably delivered, in my opinion. Then there is the Games for Impact category, which is a strange name, but games that seem to aim for emotional or social subjects get kind of shoehorned in here. And it's an interesting one this year. They've gone for A Memoir Blue, the Annapurna game that I gave a bad review to on this show earlier in the year, As Dusk Falls, which I have not played, and I'm surprised to see it here. I thought that was like a choice-based thriller of some kind. Endling Extinction is Forever, a game that I haven't even heard of. Hindsight, another game that I gave a bad review earlier in the year. I Was a Teenage Exocolonist, a game that is on my playlist by Northway Games and Finji. I'm hoping to play that one soon, actually. And then Citizen Sleeper gets a nomination here, which I was really happy to see. Such a good game, definitely on my Games of the Year long list. I was expecting to see Citizen Sleeper, or hoping to see Citizen Sleeper, in Best Indie Game. It's not there, but it's a pretty solid selection. Cult of the Lamb, Neon White, Sifu, Stray, and Tunic. I think, you know, I've reviewed two of those positively. I've reviewed two of those negatively, and Sifu I have chosen not to play. But that's an interesting selection. And then Best Debut Indie. Neon White gets an award, which is bizarre. Everyone knows that Ben Esposito made Donut County. It's mentioned every time he is. I guess New Studio was the guiding principle here. Norco also gets a nomination, a game that I was very happy to see present at the Game Awards. Such a good game. Really happy to see Citizen Sleeper and Norco here, even if they get one nomination each. Vampire Survivor is also an interesting presence in Best Debut Indie, and that's on Game Pass now, but for some reason it won't download on my Xbox. I get an error message every time I try. Don't know if it's not available in my territory or if it's streaming only or something, but it's not downloading to my Xbox even after restarting it and stuff, but I do hope to play Vampire Survivors before the end of the year. As for the rest of the nominations, it's not that interesting. I mean, those are the main ones for me, and then you get like those games spread across different categories like action and adventure and so forth. I would say that in the best family category, I was really sad not to see Tinykin. It's got Kirby and the Forgotten Land, Lego Star Wars, Mario and Rabbids, Switch Sports, and Splatoon. I guess it's the Nintendo category, but it would have been really nice to see Tinykin in there. I think that that's a really good fit there, and that's one of the only things that's like a big oversight for me, is that Tinykin is not present anywhere here. I think that Tinykin will be a bit of a surprise come Game of the Year time. A lot of people really, really like that game. I think it's much better than Kirby, for example. It's a better Nintendo game than Nintendo have made this year. Tinykin really is spectacular. I have a whole episode about it in the back catalogue. Do go and play it if you have not already. It's on Game Pass and elsewhere. But that's the Game Awards. It's an interesting selection. Some things I was really happy about. Really happy to see Stray doing very well here. Really happy to see Citizen Sleeper and Norco getting nods, even if they don't end up winning. So it's an interesting selection. And the awards themselves happen, I believe, on December the 8th. Although the time does mean that they are they begin at 12:30 in GMT, which is where I am. So it's a bit of a late night exercise if I decide to stay up and watch it this year. I did stay up and watch it last year, and I kind of regretted it. I was really tired the next day, and I didn't feel like it was worth it. It's an awful lot of trailers in the Game Awards. It gets a bit tiresome, and they really sped through the awards. I hope they give more time to the people that win awards this year and to the awards themselves, but let's see. Anyway, let's move on to the games. So the first game that I played this week is a game called The Entropy Center, which I'm playing on PS5. This is a really, really interesting one. It's really fun. If you like Portal-like games, for example, The Witness, Manifold Garden, Talos Principle, Superliminal, that kind of thing, The Entropy Center is a new entry in that genre. And that always makes me sit up and pay attention. I love a first-person puzzle game. It's a comfort food genre for me. And The Entropy Center, in my 2 hours that I've played of it so far, I think I'm probably a third of the way through the game or something like that, has been really good so far. And that's because the central control mechanism of this one is fun. Like in Portal, shooting portals to solve puzzles is fun. It leads to a lot of interesting experiments where you can, you know, you really have to work through these puzzles using the mechanics at hand and learning them to use them in new ways, like in Superliminal, being able to change the size of objects using perspective trickery was just so fun in itself that seeing all of the different ways that it was employed in puzzles was great. Same with being able to change gravity, the direction of gravity in Manifold Garden. So the quirk of the Entropy Center is that the central mechanic is a time gun that you can use to reverse time. That means that if you pick something up, put it on a switch, pick it up again, take it across the room, put it on another switch, you can find an advantageous position and then use your time gun to reverse the position of that thing that you were carrying and use the switches in unusual ways. So you can carry things around and drop them. If you point your time gun at them from somewhere else and reverse time, you will see them retracing the steps that you took, even though you are standing somewhere else completely. And this leads to a lot of ingenious puzzle stuff. It gets more complex as you go. There are different things that you can pick up, such as a trampoline or a launch ramp that you can launch yourself off that will also weigh down buttons. There are also environmental things like collapsed bridges that you can point the time gun at and reverse time to build them again. And the setting is great too. It's very much like the Portal setup. You wake up in a strange technology, sci-fi installation where everyone seems to be gone and it seems to have fallen into disrepair. And so part of what you're doing as you move through the puzzle rooms, because it's a test facility, is figuring out what the hell's going on. And there is a broader plot to it as well. So I've really been enjoying the Entropy Center. I'm about a third of the way through, maybe half. And I think I will be coming back to that one in the future for sure. It looks great. I really like the fact that it has this film grain. It does feel a little valve-y in that Portal way, like with the physics, the block physics and stuff. But it does look really nice, in my opinion. Like the architecture is really cool. Lots of Barbican-style concrete and brutalist architecture and interiors. So I'll be coming back to that one. I've also been playing this week God of War Ragnarok, which I was kind of excited about, actually. Like, the reason that I picked up God of War 2018 in the last couple of weeks and finally played through to the end was that I wanted to get up to speed for Ragnarok. And I've had a mixed first impression of it. It's a very direct continuation of God of War. Like, it looks almost the same, feels almost the same, and plays almost the same. If you played and liked God of War 2018, I think odds are you will play and like Ragnarok. But if you're expecting a big generational leap from PS4 to PS5, it's not here really. But as I said in last week's review, God of War 2018 doesn't feel like it's aged at all. So I don't really know where there is for it to go graphically. Like, God of War 2018 is as good as it gets in a lot of ways. And so God of War Ragnarok, like, it has small improvements here and there, but it looks, plays, and feels pretty much the same. The thing that slightly bugged me about the opening was that the opening of God of War 2018 was a battle with a stranger, a tattooed Viking stranger who comes to your door. And the first big boss battle in that game feels absolutely huge. Like, you're throwing each other through hillsides and cracking open the ground, and the whole battle seems to just exist on a scale that belongs only really to God of War. Like, the Bayonetta games try something similar, but God of War just do it to such a high epic degree of drama and spectacle. And God of War Ragnarok, the first couple battles pale in comparison, in my opinion, to God of War 2018. And I was very surprised by that, because I'd read some reviews that said, you know, buckle up for the first 3 hours, treat it like you would treat like a big movie, like an X-Men movie or something, you know, just get ready because this is going to be the time of your life kind of thing. And I was ready for the roller coaster to begin. And it seemed like a bit of a misfire to me. Like, there were a couple of bosses. One of them is a very fleeting encounter, like a small field boss, if you like the ogre in God of War 2018. Here it was a centaur-type creature, not a spoiler in the trailer, etc. And then you have another boss fight, which just wasn't as good as Baldur, to be frank. It was like a shadow of that fight, but it was kind of pegged as being huge, if you know what I mean. And then it spits you straight into some pretty familiar gameplay, where you're just rowing around, getting out of the boat here and there, doing three rune chests. The thing that I liked least about God of War 2018 is back. They did not change it at all. So I've had a mixed first impression of it. It's very slick, it's big, it's enjoyable, but it's a very minor... It's almost more like a continuation than a sequel. I would say think of it as God of War 2018 Part 2 and not as like a real, true sequel that amps everything up, that rethinks and improves. This game does not rethink and improve that much. But I would say that that's all pretty negative, what I've said, but I am enjoying it, and I do think that it's a quality game. It does have some twists. I think 6 hours in, you get a big gameplay twist, the first big gameplay twist, and that's very welcome to me. But overall, my opening impression of God of War Ragnarok is that it somewhat lacks the emotional heft of the first game, in which it begins with a bereavement and it's a quest to scatter some ashes. This game seems to be just gods slugging it out and whatever is the story. But, you know, people have said that it really progresses and that it has the amazing moments that we want from a God of War game. So I will keep playing it. I will... I'll probably come back to the podcast and eat my words later. And if I do, I will be very happy to do so because I want this game to be good. And that's all for the intro section. I'm going to move on to two reviews now, Somerville and Four Tales. Before I do so, let me mention briefly that this is a Patreon-supported show. There is a wonderful community of patrons who support this show, and we all hang out on Discord. There's currently a lot of game chat. There's currently a lot of chat about Twitter and Elon Musk driving into the ground. There's currently a little bit of pre-World Cup excitement. So there are game channels. People are playing all kinds of games all the time. A lot of chat about Pentiment currently. Some people playing God of War Ragnarok and some off-topic channels as well. And you're welcome to come and join us at patreon.com/gamingintheWild for as little as $1 a month. You can become a supporter of the podcast and join the community. You also get a whole bunch of bonus episodes of me talking about music and video game music, off-topic subjects, travel, that sort of thing. So it's patreon.com/gamingintheWild if you are interested in that. Thanks very much to my existing patrons, and thanks to you if that's something that you would consider doing. And with that said, let's move on to the first review of this episode, Somerville. So Somerville is a game that came out this week. I'm recording in November of 2022, if you're listening in the future. That's when Somerville came out. It is by Jumpship. It's the first game by this studio. And I think it's worth doing a little bit of backstory on this one, because it is very famously made by one half of the Playdead studio. Playdead made Inside and Limbo, and is a very highly rated studio. Dino Patti was the CEO of Playdead, and he had an acrimonious split with that studio, and the partnership was cleaved in two. They had a business falling out, basically, and he left Playdead with €7.2 million, reportedly, after a falling out with Arnt Jensen. Arnt Jensen was the creative director of the studio and the director of Inside and Limbo. And whilst the creative split between the two isn't exactly known, like, we don't know, in a two-person studio, or at least a studio fronted by two people, in which one is the CEO and one is the creative director, I guess that does split, it suggests a split in areas of responsibility. So Dino Patti was the CEO. This studio, Jumpship, is, I guess, what he did with the money. He is half of Playdead. And that has been the reason that the world seems interested in Somerville. Is that Playdead connection, and this game is considered to have come off the lineage of Inside. It was announced in the release week of Somerville that Jumpship has been acquired by the publisher Thunderful, which is interesting. Although, I guess, given the reception of this game, they might want to be checking their receipts there. It has a 68 on Metacritic on Xbox, 1.5 from users, which is amongst the worst user ratings that I have seen for a game on Metacritic. It takes about 3.5 hours to complete, according to How Long to Beat. I've played it for about 1.5 hours across four sessions, all of which ended with me turning off the game in disgust, it's fair to say, and I'll be getting into why throughout this review. So I'll start by describing what this game is. It does have an inside vibe in that it's dark and moody, but inside was a left-to-right platform puzzler, I guess, heavy on atmosphere, heavy on art style. In this game, you run from right to left, and rather than it being this illustrated feeling 2.5D environment, this time we have low-poly graphics, which feels different. And rather than that gothic stylized feel of Limbo, or the like crisp, desaturated, gloomy style of Inside, this is a little bit different. It's a little bit more basic feeling in some ways. I was reminded of old games like Prince of Persia and the Amiga game Another World. And I think that's something to do with the unresponsiveness of the main character, and something to do with the size of them on the screen, or the art style generally. But it's a nighttime game in which you'll be running through a dark world, basically, from right to left. 2.5D, which does mean that it's a 3D rendered world, but your movement is limited mostly right to left, but occasionally at designated spots, although it isn't exactly clear when. You can walk into the screen. There is a tracking camera in this game, which I think is one of the best things about it. It does have a cinematic feel in that inside way. So as you run, it's not like a pure scrolling camera on a horizontal axis. It will move and accelerate and decelerate in a way that feels more like a shot in a cinema film than a game camera. So it's got that advanced, interesting camera that Inside had, that tracks you, the shifts in perspective and that sort of thing. It's often quite zoomed out, so your character is often quite small on the screen, which is interesting in that it lets you see the background, it lets you see landscapes, and in those landscapes you can see interesting things happen. You're running through world events, basically, in the form of an alien invasion. It's got a War of the Worlds vibe going on here. In terms of controls, there is a multi-purpose action button, and you use that for every interactable in the game. For example, picking something up, grabbing something to drag it, that kind of thing. You also use it to climb or to mantle onto surfaces. I would say that this button feels supremely unreliable. I don't know if it's because of the slow animations that your character goes through when they carry this thing out, but I felt that you had to be standing on the right pixel in order for an interaction to actually initiate. I did spend quite a lot of time jabbing the button frustratedly, trying to, for example, mantle onto a surface that's clearly physically possible for the character, but that ledge has not been made interactive by the game. There's a lot of invisible walls in this game. In terms of picking something up, I found that it was really unreliable as well. You can stand near an object and press it, and it won't work unless you are in precisely the right place, which leads to a very frustrating, underdeveloped control scheme. There is also a special ability button. Your character gets a special ability at the start of the game. You can make your arm glow, and that will have some effect on the environment sometimes. In terms of the setup and scenario, which is probably the strongest aspect of this game, it begins really interestingly. There is a family driving. You get these tracking shots across the road from above, from the side, and like these beautiful landscape shots of a car driving through rural scenery. They arrive home. They get out of the car. It's a sweet homecoming scene with a dog barking, a couple, and their toddler. It's a story that lacks dialogue, but it does lean into cinematic tropes in a way that I think is actually quite good. So you do get marginally invested in this family's situation and safety, I would say. They go into the house, they fall asleep in front of the TV, and then you get control, interestingly, of the toddler rather than the protagonist of the game, which is the husband of the family. And so you're controlling this little kid in a dark house. You can hop off the sofa and do this like funny little toddler walk around. pretty slow. It's interesting to see, interesting to play. Like, I smiled when I realized I was controlling a toddler, but controlling the toddler is pretty miserable. Like, the walking is weird. It's not very responsive. And so I got initial alarm bells right off the bat. I was like, I see what they are trying to do here, but this feels bad. And I think if I was to condense my entire feelings about this game into one sentence, I see what they're trying to do here, but this feels bad, is probably it. Because as you're controlling this baby, like, I didn't know exactly what to do. I ran around the house quite slowly and cumbersomely several times. And there are interactables that weren't clear to me. And when I did interact with things, I wasn't sure what I should be doing with them. And so the whole thing was instantly pretty slow, pretty frustrating, and a little unreliable in the controls. But the prelude ends when the baby opens a window, and you see outside that there are red lights in the distance. There are strange sounds floating through the night air, and something bad is going on outside. What follows is a pretty cool alien invasion scene. There are pillars coming down from the sky. In the Independence Day style, some events occur. The husband gets stuck under rafters, and that's the prelude. You wake up and the game begins. You are alone in the collapsed house, and you run out into the environment to, I guess, look for your missing family, to survive and to figure out what the hell's going on. And you start running through the forest, basically, down your driveway and into the forest with this great tracking camera. And what you notice is that there are pillars hanging in the air. There are strange, robotic-looking creatures stalking the forest with red spotlights. There are red spotlights coming down from the sky occasionally that you have to run away from. And you set out on a journey. I really liked it. It's creepy and interesting. The atmosphere is good. And then you run into your first couple of puzzles. I think something that you are taught pretty much straight away is that light dispels this strange, rippling alien matter that looks like, you know, those things that have pins on them and you push your hand into them and you get an impression of your hand. It's like one of those, except rippling. So it's this strange alien matter that blocks your way. If you shine lights onto it, it dispels. And the first puzzle that I came to in the game after I got out of the house was a crashed fighter plane. And you're supposed to use a street light, using a switch to dispel the alien matter and move forward. I got stuck. I couldn't figure out that whenever you use the switch to turn the light on, something collapses on you. But it's a street light. I thought, I can't move it. It's pointing wherever it's pointing. I'm just a little guy. I can't just rip this thing up. Turns out that you do have to basically move it. There is no button prompt for that. You have not done anything like that so far in the game. And so it's a frustrating failure to give me the information that I needed to solve this intensely simple puzzle. This is a recurring theme. The second time I got stuck in like a little grove where there were some cute little rolling creatures rolling around that I could interact with by using my special glow ability, but not in any meaningful way, and it's a dead end. So I'm in this grove. There is a climbable-looking ledge to the left. There is a walkable-looking route into the screen. I spent ages running against them, jabbing that button, hoping that my character would duck under a branch or mantle onto a surface and let me progress in the game. I also spent a lot of time interacting with the little rolling creatures, which did respond to me. And I was thinking, what the hell am I missing here? I ended up looking up a solution, a video playthrough. Turns out there's nothing to do there. It's just a dead end. And the way forward was out from where I was. I had just missed it because I tried to run left and hit an obstacle and thought, oh, that's an invisible wall. Clearly I can't go left. It was just an obstacle. It was just a rock that I was running into. So invisible walls are everywhere in this game, and they negatively affect gameplay because you're not sure where you can go. The environment is very drab and desaturated. It doesn't read well. You can't see your way forward. And when it comes to puzzles, the interactable elements need to be able to be highlighted, or you should get button prompts. Neither thing is present. So I think the assumption is that the designers of the game feel that it reads well enough that players will figure this out in good time. I disagree with them on that. I think that the environment doesn't read well. And without button prompts, without proper tutorialization, without highlightable interactable objects, this is a catastrophic design decision that made the game borderline unplayable to me. So I think this is a bad video game. I think that lots of decisions that were taken here are mistakes, like pure and simple. It's not that I don't like the game, like I want to like it. I think the art style is cool. I think the scenario is cool. But this is a very rare instance where I will review a game and I will say that the design decisions in this game are not good. This is a bad video game. Nothing is intuitive. I could not intuit what to do. Every couple of screens, I came to a screeching halt. Nothing like Inside, where you work your way intuitively through a series of interesting puzzles and environments. Inside obviously swept the board for Game of the Year awards and was a huge hit. This game is a huge mess. I found the puzzle logic to be inconsistent. I found the inputs to be unreliable. Like, as simple a thing as picking something up doesn't always work in this game. You can try five times sometimes, and unless your character is standing in the right place, it won't work. The character is too small on the screen, which hinders you in that you don't know if you're standing in the right place to do things, because it's more interested in the cinematic, scenic presentation than in actually allowing the player to play the game. Things that don't look climbable are climbable. Things that do look climbable aren't climbable. So again, this reading problem of how the game reads visually, it's not right. So I'm left wondering if the fact that Playdead split into two between Art Jensen, the director of Inside and Limbo, and Dino Patti, the CEO of the company, I'm left wondering if most of the game-making chops lay in the other half of this partnership, because there's a lot of things about Somerville that feel like they could have been mitigated or worked out, like some of the basics, interacting with objects, the way that you move, the way that you read the environment, the way that it all hangs together, are out of place and uncomfortable in this game. There's a lot of resistance, there's a lot of friction. I think that there's a lot of sandpaper rough friction in actually controlling and playing this game in a way that Inside and Limbo just really did not have. However, Playdead is making another game. Interestingly, they've been advertising for staff to make an open world 3D game, which is fascinating. So that's something to be excited about for fans of Inside. I would suggest that Somerville, whilst being billed as a spiritual successor to Inside, isn't as such. For me, this is a really flawed game amongst the worst games I've played this year, sadly. So that's my review of Somerville. Other people have enjoyed it more than me, so I think I'm coming down in the low scale. It's interesting to me that critics have rated it in the 6-7 bracket, but user reviews on Metacritic have it between 1-3. So players aren't liking this game. It's interesting to be checking out the reviews for this one. When I have such a purely negative take on the game, I'm curious if it's just me or if it is like a game issue. And so I've been surveying the coverage of this one. Even the people that like it do recognize that it has a lot of problems. Anyway, that's enough about Somerville. Let's move on to the next game of this episode, the final review of this episode. It's a card game called Four Tales. So Four Tales is a 2022 game by Alchemy. It's published by Dear Villagers. The music is by Christophe Herral and Raphael Joff. It has a 75 on Metacritic from only a handful of reviews. How long to beat has it at 9 to 11 hours. I've played 6 hours of it so far. I've played those 6 hours twice. I kind of hit a wall in my first playthrough where I felt some of my decisions had gone the wrong way. And so I decided to try it again, but hit the same wall on my second playthrough. And the studio described this one by saying, "Decide the fate of the world in this ingenious, story-driven card game. Four Tales offers a unique take on the adventure game, with a multitude of playstyles and story paths through which you can save the world or bring about its end." And I describe this one by saying it's a well-presented, narrative-driven card game in a medieval fantasy world in which your deck is used for decision-making as well as combat, a system that is in turns imaginative and obtuse. And in this game you play as Volpan, an anthropomorphic bird, a shoebill, who lives in a kingdom that's undergoing various upheavals. There is a plague going around the kingdom, there is a cult that is on the rise, law is breaking down, there are bandits everywhere, there are labour disputes and so forth. There's a lot going on in this world. And at the start of the game, Volpan is hired to try and steal a lyre, like a stringed instrument. And when he does steal this lyre, that's the first mission of the game, he starts to have visions. He starts to have visions about a terrible future for this kingdom, for this realm. He sees a city on fire. He sees friends going through all kinds of troubles. He sees executions and imprisonments. And with all of these visions in his mind, Volpan doesn't know what to do, and you get to make decisions about what path he chooses to take. And so the name Four Tales is interesting in that Volpan is having premonitions about the fate of the realm, and armed with that foreknowledge, Volpan can choose where to go, what to do, what situations to try and intervene in, or whether to intervene at all, and the world will change based on those decisions. And I really like that premise. So it's a branching paths game in which your choices are meaningful. You will be presented with choices. Where do I go? What do I do? If there is a city that Volpan has seen burning down in a vision, do you go to the city to try and prevent that? But at the same time, Volpan's father is a miner, and one of his visions is that the miners are going to be crushed in a strike by authoritarian forces, and you can only choose one of them. You can't do all of the things in this game. Choosing one will often rule out another, and no outcomes are guaranteed either way based on what you do in your missions. Whether you succeed or fail, future options will become available to you or become unavailable to you and be ruled out. So it's an interesting game based on Volpan the Thief having premonitions of the future and trying to decide what to do. And interestingly, you're always looking at a tabletop in this game. You have a deck of cards on the left. You have scenario cards that are dealt opposite to you. And they might be a street or a character to interact with. And you play your cards into various scenarios, whether it's an empty street, whether it's a person, whether it's a judge in a court or a mysterious doorway. And your cards, they have ostensible uses. For example, Volpan can throw a smoke grenade or a pepper bomb, and in combat that will stun your opposition. But then if you use it in, for example, a public place, it might cause disorder to happen, which could have story effects. And so what you have is a set of cards that have one use that you are aware of, for example, to pickpocket, to listen, to overhear, to throw a pepper bomb. And you play those both in combat and you play them in story mode too. And so there's a process that goes on of you trying to figure out what will happen if I play this card in different scenarios. And that they have unforeseen effects, basically. And this leads to both some interesting moments where you will decide to play a card and get an unexpected story effect, and frustrating moments in which you have a limited set of cards, and you are not sure exactly what to do to achieve the story aim that you want. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword, this mechanic. The game describes itself as ingenious, and I wouldn't argue. It is ingenious to have cards that have multiple uses in different scenarios. But it did lead me sometimes to be really stuck, and when I found solutions or even looked them up, to roll my eyes a little and be like, well, I didn't think that that card would have that effect. So there's a little bit of a cause and effect gap in this game. But you have several characters. You start with Volpan and his friend. You can pick up other characters along the way. Each of them has different types of abilities and different decks of their own. And on the table that you're looking at, location and character cards are dealt from the scenario deck. And you can drag your cards onto them to generate the effects that you want. If you drag Pickpocket onto a merchant, you might steal their gold. If you drag that gold onto a tavern card, you might buy food, which can be used to increase your health. If you drag a scouting card onto a forest, you might discover a bandit camp or a watch outpost and that kind of thing. And it's this chained thing where the scenario cards will change when you play a card onto it and you'll be taken somewhere else. So the story is unfolding through card gameplay. The tabletop that you're looking down onto is wooden. The light changes based on where you are. For example, if you're in a forest, you might hear birdsong and see sunlight falling onto the table. If you're under the ground in a sewer, the light turns blue and rippling, like it's bouncing from water, and you get the atmosphere that you are somewhere else. You can also get object cards. For example, if you find a bunch of thieves in a hidden den, you can drag your gold card onto them and buy a throwing knife or a dagger. You can then use that in combat. And when you're in combat, you're presented with enemies opposite you on the table instead of those scenario and place cards. You can use some offensive card abilities that your characters have. For example, one of them has a bow and arrow, a crack shot. You drag that onto the enemy, and you'll fire an arrow and take down their health. You can use one of those cards that you found, like a firebomb or a throwing knife, and that will reduce their health too. After you've exhausted your cards in the turn, an auto battle mechanic kicks in. You'll do damage, you'll take damage, and then it's back to your turn, and you can actually mindfully play cards again. When you run out of turns, then you go into the auto battle. Your health will go down, their health will go down, and so forth. If you kill an enemy, you'll get a grim card. This is like your reputation, your negative reputation. You can also drag coins onto enemies, though. So you can play this game in a pacifist way. So if you drag gold onto a watch guard, then you can bribe them and they will just leave the battlefield. Or if you drag grim onto your enemies, they have morale. If their morale reaches zero, they will flee the battlefield and you will get fame. You can spend fame in combat to just intimidate people into running away. You can spend fame on people in the story mode and they will react to your presence, having heard rumors about you, positive or negative. So everything is very interlocked between story and combat. The combat is not traditional, so it's not Slay the Spire-y. It's not like an in-depth combat system. It's more that you're negotiating and navigating your way through this world using your fame, your notoriety, your money, and the objects that you have found, and your skills as well. So it's a very multifaceted system, and it is interesting to play for sure. I think the visual style is quite nice. The cards are nicely illustrated. I enjoy that when you use a throwing knife, for example, a 3D knife will appear and spin across the table and land on an enemy card and reduce their health. When you fire the bow, the same thing happens. So there are nice little animations woven into it. I like the light changes. I think that's really cool. I love that whilst you're always looking at a table, the atmosphere can change significantly based on these cool visual filters that happen. The sound palette is nice. It gives you a nice feel for where you are. The fact that the shot never changes. Like, the story manages to summon a lot of atmosphere about whether you are in a forest, whether you're in a town, through the light, through the sound, through the people that you encounter, through the scenario cards that are dealt to you. It does a great job at suggesting that you're weaving your way through an interesting world. It does a lot with a little, and I really like that about it. It has nice instrumental music throughout. It can repeat a little too often. I think sometimes you spend 10 minutes in a town and you're just listening to a 2-minute piece of music loop. That kind of thing does get to me after a while. Some sections can even take 20 or 30 minutes to play and the music doesn't change. That's a bit of an issue. It has voice acting. There will be an occasional line spoken now and then. Those two can get repetitive. For example, if you play Grim to shoo off an enemy and intimidate them, your friend will often say, "Bad bird. I got so tired of hearing bad bird." And if you spend your fame, your character will often say, "That's right, it's the Volpan. And I got really tired of hearing that too. It was used so often." So there's a lot to like about this game. I like the ingenuity of the card mechanic. I like the potential of it. I don't feel that that potential is fully realized. I feel that sometimes the cause and effect is a little bit off in this game, and that leads to a pretty big problem. It leads to you replaying scenarios, and if you replay them, you have to go through all the same dialogue. You have to go through basically the same gauntlet of enemies and scenarios and situations and play the same cards again and just try and do it better. And replaying isn't fun in this game. So when I run into problems where I was just plain stuck and I had to look it up, I was often a little bit miffed about the solutions. Like, I didn't feel that I could have gotten to it. You have a begging card, for example, and you can use that to ask for help. So if you play it in a market square, you can receive gold from passers-by. If you play it with the watch, then they will respond to you and they will go and chase off some of the enemies in your enemy deck. But other times, that begging card, which you've grown accustomed to the use of, has to be used with a specific character in a specific moment. And I couldn't quite join the dots. Like, I didn't quite see that if I played the begging card whilst in a court of law, that the judge might respond positively or sympathetically to me, because I was used to using that card to get gold. And if that card doesn't happen to be in your hand at the right time, because your skill cards are dealt to you in a random order, then you're just stuck. You don't realize you have to beg a judge. You try listening to try and pick up something from the jury. You can even try the pepper bomb to bring the court into disarray, which will have a negative outcome in loads of combat. If you don't happen to have the right card and to join those dots at the right time, then you're frozen out of the puzzle, and you're probably going to have to play that again, and you might never arrive at that right conclusion. So I found this to be quite infuriating. It started to feel a little like point and clicky, like the negative side of point and clicks, where you don't know that you're supposed to use the banana on the cat to make it jump onto the roof to make the roof fall down or whatever. It started to feel like the worst excesses of the point and click genre, where the logic of the puzzle is perhaps disconnected to what the game has taught you about the use of your own cards. This can be pretty confusing, pretty frustrating. I've ended up walking circles of levels, trying out cards on different situations, not because I think it's going to work, but just because I have to try something. And also, if you spend all of your cards, you can rest to replenish your deck. They don't just go back into your deck, so you can't just play indefinitely. After a while, you'll run out of refreshes, and your characters will just be too tired to continue. And so I lost the patience with this game a little bit because of that. I must have played, I would say, 10 hours or so of this game. My first playthrough, I came to a scenario where I felt that it was impossible for me to continue, despite starting it several times. Like, I hadn't gathered the right characters with me. Choices that you make will mean that people join or leave your party, and you can choose party members to join you in any given chapter. And I had lost some of my tribe. Like, I had four characters to choose from at one point. One of them left. One of them seemed a little useless. And I felt that the characters that I had as party members weren't the characters that I needed to get through this scenario. And so I've actually quit playing this game twice now, which is really sad, because when it's going well, it feels great. But when it's going badly, it can just be impenetrable and obtuse. So this is another game that I enjoyed on some levels, but I was bummed out by on others. To run through the positives and negatives of this one. The visual presentation is lovely. I love the deck. I love the light on the card table. I love the effects when you throw things and use your abilities. I like the nicely drawn cards. And if you throw a smoke bomb, then you'll see smoke in the game, which is really fun. It's really fun to have these physical outcomes from playing your cards. It's really great to look at. The sound palette is nice too. The music is good, although it loops a little too often. The voice acting is good, although both get repetitive. The story through cards mechanic isn't something that I've quite seen before. Like, things like Griftlands and Signs of the Sojourner use cards for story effects, but I hadn't quite seen the deck being used in this way, where you can argue your way out of combat, or you can trip into it, where you can use combat cards in the story to trigger events that are interesting. But the logic of the deck seems off to me. So the ingenuity of the card mechanic is kind of undercut by the obscurity of some of the solutions. So I would say it's a half-successful experiment. And the successful half is a really fun mechanic. I would also say that the location is nice, the scenario is nice, the story situations, the dialogue and the writing are good, and it's cleverly done. And when it's working as expected, it's a really fun time. On the downside, the logic is sometimes off. The controls on Switch are weird, like it doesn't quite feel good on a controller, but then you can use the touchscreen. I played it mostly using the touchscreen, but the touchscreen controls were a little unreliable. If you're dragging a card from a deck to a person, if you're dragging like a healing potion to someone that is on the right-hand side of your party, it doesn't work. You'll end up carrying gold. So the cards jump around a little with the touch controls, which is really unfortunate because this does seem like a good touchscreen game. On controllers, it's a little more cumbersome. So maybe the way to play this game is actually using a mouse. But the biggest downer of all is just that I couldn't finish the game. I played to the halfway point twice. I got to a level where you have to, first of all, you have to find a specific sewer grate. And there are some interesting ways that you can do that. You have to find the thieves and ask them the way to head into the sewers and meet this character that you need to meet down there. And then in the sewers, you have to battle your way through a bunch of monsters, find torches that you can use to light dark passageways, and then fight a big bad down in the sewer. Then when you come out of the sewer, there's more to do still. And I was just running out of cards. So I don't know if I was missing something in the way that I was playing, but several times I tried everything I could think of. I tried to gather enough gold, gather enough food, have my characters be strong with throwing knives and with things to use in combat. But I just couldn't get through it a bunch of times. Like everything I tried seemed to fail. And so the game wasn't helping me at all at this point, and I really felt just stuck. And as I said, it's not fun to replay levels because you hear the same dialogue. You can't click through it even. You just have to sit through the dialogue. So there are some big problems in this game. I like the things it does well. I'm sad about the things that it doesn't. I don't think I will get to the end of it. But I would be really curious to hear from people that did do well with Four Tales. I would love to hear if others gelled better with the actions they were expected to take. The sense of ingenuity in using a card to achieve an unexpected effect was something that worked really well, but sometimes I just wasn't on the same wavelength as the game. And I guess that's what this one comes down to. If you find your wavelength with Four Tales, you could have a really good time. Sadly, I didn't. It was a bit of a bumpy ride. I don't think I will get to the end of it. I have tried twice and put the hours in, but I just can't quite find the right wavelength for me to finish the game. That's Four Tales. So that's my episode. I just played a couple games this week and didn't really like them. Unfortunately, like if you're a solo podcaster like me, you kind of have to just talk about what you played from week to week. You know, I don't plan ahead intensely. I tend to just talk about what I'm playing. Usually that means that I try and choose games that I'm gonna, that there's a high percentage chance that I'm gonna like, you know, and that's by listening to reviews, by reading about games that are coming out, by following developers that I know make good games. And I really felt like Somerville and Four Tales might be a couple of hits for me. A story, hand-illustrated, story-led, narrative card game that got fairly decent reviews, and something from one of the creators of Inside felt like really safe bets. It turned out that neither of those games were good, but as the weekend came around, that's what I played. And so whilst I like to celebrate games and I don't really like to critique and to be negative on the show, it's just what happened this week. So I do hope that you enjoyed the episode. And I'm just doing a lot of apologising for being negative that I probably don't have to do. Thanks very much for listening. You can come and find me on Twitter at Gaming in the Wild. I would love to hear from you if you've played those games and had other experiences. If you'd like to join us on Discord, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. And for $1 a month, you can join in with our conversations, recommend games for me to cover on the podcast, get the extra episodes, all that kind of thing. That's it from me for this week. I think next time I might well come back with a review of the Entropy Center, or maybe I will start Pentiment. Hopefully I will have some more positive reviews for you next week. In the meantime, please do take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.